Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Exodus chapter 24. I'm going to do the whole chapter this time, verses 1 through 18. I'm going to call this chapter The Covenant Confirmed. This is the chapter that talks about the ceremony of the blood covenant between Israel and the people and the ratification or the confirmation of what Moses heard on Mount Sinai about the Ten Commandments and the elaborations on the Ten Commandments called the Book of the Covenant, which we've just gone over. Exodus 20, first part of the chapter is the Ten Commandments, and then starting, somewhere in the middle of Exodus 20 down to somewhere in the middle of Exodus 23, we've got the Book of the Covenant, which has all kind of laws about bailment, sexual crimes, restitution, defamation, legal stuff. So now we start in Exodus 24, verses 1 and 2. Then he, that's God, said to Moses, "Come up to the Lord, you and Aaron and Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and you shall worship at a distance. Moses alone, however, shall come near to the Lord, but they shall not come near, nor shall the people come up with him." So what we see here, the people, they're scared to death. They're a long way from the boundary that they had put up around Mount Sinai to keep people from crossing that boundary. And if you crossed it, man or beast, you would be executed. So the people were way back, but God says, "No, I'm going to give some of you permission to come." And so 70 elders, Aaron, Moses' brother, the future high priest, and his sons, Nadab and Abihu, they came across that boundary and walked up a little ways. We can see that as we get into the chapter. They ate a meal with the Lord, so they were part way up. And then after that, Moses is going to take Joshua out of the assembly of Nadab, Abihu, and 70 of the elders. Joshua was there, and so was Hur, for that matter. They're not mentioned here, but they were there. And then Moses takes Joshua, and he starts going up, and then he leaves Joshua behind, and Moses goes up all by his lonesome to the very top. So that's a preview of what's going to happen. Now, who's this Nadab and Abihu that were with the first company that crossed the boundary? As I said, they were sons of Aaron, Aaron's two oldest sons, as the NIV Study Bible points out. They're famous because they got killed for offering strange fire. We read that in Leviticus 10, verses 1 and 2. Now, Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took their respective fire pans, and after putting fire in them, placed incense on it and offered strange fire before the Lord. Now, I love that expression, strange fire. It just means fire that was not in accordance with the prescribed legal ritual requirements. They offered strange fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them, and fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. Numbers 3, verse 4, "But Nadab and Abihu died before the Lord when they offered strange fire before the Lord in the wilderness of Sinai, and they had no children. So Eleazar and Ithamar served as priests in the lifetime of their father Aaron." So Nadab and Abihu lost the priesthood, and Eleazar and Ithamar carried it on. Now the 70 elders, there were more than 70 elders in Israel. It says 70 of the elders of Israel. So these were hand-picked elders, apparently, by Moses. Maybe elders of sterling reputation. The fact that they had to stay at a distance, I assume that's at a distance from the top of Mount Sinai, that's to show the holiness of God. You just don't walk up to God without being invited. You crash that God's party, and you're likely to get fried, just like Nadab and Abihu. God cannot be in the presence of sin. Adam Clark says they're at the foot of the mountain. The people that Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu were at the foot of the mountain, I'm not so sure. I think they might have crossed the boundary. It's not clear. They might have gone up a little ways, but somewhere, either at the foot, they could be at the foot of the mountain past the boundary, or it could be at the foot of the mountain before the boundary, or it could be part way up the mountain. I'm not sure, but they didn't go all the way near the top. But Moses got to go near to God, which is quite an honor. Moses talked to God face to face. Not many people can say they've done that. Exodus 24, verses 3 through 5. These verses are next. "Then Moses came and recounted to the people all the words of the Lord and all the ordinances. And all the people answered with one voice and said, 'All the words which the Lord has spoken we will do.' Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. Then he arose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain with 12 pillars for the 12 tribes of Israel. He sent young men of the sons of Israel, and they offered burnt offerings and sacrificed young bulls as peace offerings to the Lord." Now, verse 1 says, God says to Moses, "Come up to the Lord." Apparently, Moses hasn't come up to the Lord yet, hasn't crossed the boundary and climbed the mountain all the way to the top yet, because in verses 3 through 5, he's recounting what he'd already heard on the mountain before. In the previous chapters, I counted 3 times. He went up to the top and came down 3 times. I'm assuming this is his third time down. I would not bet my life on my count. It's a little tiny detail that I'm curious about for I don't know why, but the commentators that I read a ton of them. Nobody said a word about it. So I'm going to assume that that Moses is down at the foot of the mountain three times and he's recounting the Book of the Covenant as well as the Ten Commandments. Notice the people answered and said, oh, we'll do it all the words which his Lord will have spoken we'll do. Yeah, that's famous last words. They didn't do it. Let me give you an alternate explanation of what I said. Maybe the up in verse 1 is the fourth time up the mountain, and he came back and told the people of Israel what the words, the Ten Commandments, and the Book of the Covenant was. I don't know if that's true because we've already had all the Book of the Covenant in the past several chapters. It sounds like he was already down there, so I guess I probably shouldn't have even brought that up. It's not important. The words that Moses recounted to the people, that's probably the technical word for commandments, the 10 words, as I pointed out in chapter 20. The 10 words, i.e. the 10 commandments, as the NIV Study Bible says. The ordinances, the words of the 10 commandments, and all the ordinances, that would probably refer to the Book of the Covenant, which consisted of laws against bailment, sexual crimes, restitution, defamation, etc., etc., etc. The people answered with one voice, we're going to do it. Now, there's a question here. Did all the 600,000 men plus the women, let's just say it's the men, 600,000 people all said, we will do it. That must have been a loud voice, or it could be that they had spokesmen that agreed, spoke for the rest of the people, maybe some of the prominent elders, and said, we'll do it. I'm not sure how that worked. Now, verse 4 says, Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. So he had heard all these words from God orally, through his ears. God spoke orally, Moses heard orally, and he comes down from the mountain, he writes it all down. Now Moses, of course, learned how to write when he was in Egypt. He was a well-educated guy. I don't know what language he was using. Don't ask me that. I don't know, but he wrote it down. Now, why would he write it down? Well, because he's going to have to remember all this, and he's going to have to be a lawgiver. He's going to have to be a judge. It's kind of hard to be a judge when you don't have the law written down. Now, all the people in verse 3 were all gathered around in a solemn ceremony to make the people remember this important event, as Adam Clark said. Jameson, Foster, and Brown point out this was a national covenant. It was not just a covenant between two people. It was between God and a nation. So it was a big deal. And to show that it was a big deal, in verse 4, Moses took 12 pillars and built an altar. Of course, 12 pillars stood for the 12 tribes of Israel. The idea being the 12 tribes of Israel will be faithful to Yahweh and keep all those commandments that Moses just wrote down. Verse 5, that's Moses, sent young men of the sons of Israel, and they offered burnt offerings and sacrificed young bulls as peace offerings to the Lord. So this shows that burnt offerings and peace offerings were around before the law codified the practice of offering those kind of offerings. It was not priests that did it. There were no priests established yet. So Moses sent young men. The NIV Study Bible says, yes, young men did sacrifices, and said sometimes the elders did sacrifices. I don't know how they knew that. Maybe they're just speculating. But at any rate, there weren't any priests to do it. Now, the burnt offerings were generally sheep and goats. In this case, I think he mentions oxen, young bulls. A burnt offering is one that is a holocaust offering, wholly burned by fire. It shows total consecration to God because the sacrifice is totally consumed and floats up in smoke to God, just like the worshiper is totally consumed in his soul, and his soul ascends unto God completely with nothing left back. None of the worshiper was left behind, just like none of the burnt offering was left behind because it was wholly consumed. Now, a peace offering was, as the NIV translates it, the fellowship offering. That consisted generally of a bull or a goat, as Clark says, and the blood of the peace offering was poured out before the Lord on the altar, the blood talking about sacrifice and redemption from sins, life for life. And then the notable thing about a peace offering is the people and the priests ate the flesh. Now, there weren't any priests there, but they were elders there representing Israel, and I'm sure that Moses and the leaders and Aaron ate the meal with all the elders, signifying the fellowship between the Hebrews and themselves, but also between God and the people. There's peace between the two. We go down to Exodus 24, 6 through 8. Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins. That's the blood of those sacrificed bulls and goats for the peace and the burnt offerings. Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins, and the other half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. Then he took the Book of the Covenant and read it in the hearing of the people. And they said, all that the Lord has spoken we will do, and we will be obedient. Yeah, right. So Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people and said, behold, the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words. All right, so he took half of the blood, put it in basins. Now, that half of the blood is going to be sprinkled on two places. Once on the Book of the Covenant. Well, it actually doesn't say that. Commentators speculate that. But it states explicitly in verse 8 that half of the blood would be sprinkled on the people. In Hebrews, it says that the blood was sprinkled on the book, i.e. the Book of the Covenant. I'll read that in a minute. So that's half the blood, half on the people. Let's put it this way. A quarter on the people, a quarter on the Book of the Covenant. And then the other half was sprinkled on the altar. Now, of course, blood symbolizes life because life is in the blood. And it also symbolizes that life will be given for life. The sacrifice of the animal is prototypical or a shadow or typical of the antitypical sacrifice, which was Jesus on the cross. And the fact that the blood was also sprinkled on the people and on the book, that symbolized that the book contains laws that which, if you don't keep them, you're going to die. Your life is going to be taken away from you. And so you better rely on that blood that's on the altar. Now, the Book of the Covenant, upon which a quarter of the blood was sprinkled, that's the book that starts in the middle of Exodus 20 and goes all the way, or mostly all the way through chapter 23. As I said, it's the book that has all the elaborations of the Ten Commandments, the laws against defamation, theft, manslaughter, that sort of thing, legal stuff. Now, let me read you the verse in Hebrews 9:19 that shows that a quarter of the blood, a part of the basin that had half the blood left in it, was sprinkled on the Book of the Covenant as well as the people. The Book of the Covenant, which Moses had written down, he heard it orally from God on Mount Sinai, then he had written it down. Hebrews 9:19, for when every commandment had been spoken by Moses to all the people according to the law, he took the blood of the cows and the goats with water and scarlet wool and hyssop and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people. Now, when Moses presents this book to them, he read it to them, actually, those couple of chapters in Exodus, he read it to them, and then the people said, we will do it and be obedient. They had already said that they would be obedient when Moses had orally told them about the book of the law earlier. In verse 3, we read that, then Moses came and recounted to the people all the words of the Lord and all the ordinances, and all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which the Lord has spoken, we will do. So they've already promised after they heard the oral rendition, and now after it was read, the book was read to them. In verse 7, the people said, oh, all that has been spoken we will do. So they heard it orally, then they heard it read to them, and both times they said, we will be obedient. And of course, their actions did not conform with their words. Their talk did not match. Excuse me, their walk did not match their talk. Let's read Deuteronomy 5:28 in that connection. The Lord heard the voice of your words when you spoke to me, and the Lord said to me, I have heard the voice of the words of this people which they have spoken to you. They have done well in all that they have spoken. Well, they've done well in all that they have spoken, but they didn't do well in all that they promised to do. They spoke with their mouth, but they didn't conform. After all, every last one of them died in the wilderness unless they were under 20 years old before they got to the promised land, and it was because of their gross sin. Now, the blood on the people, it represented a blood oath. Blood oath is very important. It would bind them in obedience. All covenants were ratified with sacrifices, and I think the idea is if you don't keep this covenant, your blood's going to flow from your body. You're going to die. I haven't been able to confirm that, but I think that's true. Now, which part of the people were sprinkled? All of them? Well, that's not possible. There was 2.5 million of them, if you count the women and children. 600,000 males. There's not enough blood in the animals to do that. So it could have been the blood was sprinkled on the young men that offered the sacrifices that we mentioned, or it could be the blood was spread on the 70 elders, which I think makes a lot of sense because the elders represented the people, or it could be the blood was sprinkled on the 12 pillars, the 12 pillars standing for Israel. I can go along with that. John Gill and Jameson Fawcett Brown mentioned that idea. Now, this blood is called blood of the covenant. As I said, most covenants were instituted with the sacrifice of an animal. And most covenants, I think the idea about that was that the blood will flow out of the animal if represents that somebody's going to get killed if they don't keep the covenant. Here, I think it's also representing the life of the sacrifice. His blood, his life flows out, which means that he dies instead of the people dies because he is a sacrifice for the people, given for the sins of the people, just like Jesus' blood, just like Jesus' life was poured out for his people. In fact, that phrase, blood of the covenant, is used in the New Testament to refer to the blood of Jesus flowing out for the covering of our sins. Mark 14:24, and he said to them, "This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many." It's referring to the communion. Matthew 26:28, "For this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for forgiveness of sins." Again, referring to the communion. And in 1 Corinthians 11:25, "In the same way he took the cup also after supper, saying, 'This cup is the new covenant in my blood.'" It's not quite the same phrase as blood of the covenant, but new covenant in my blood is pretty close. "Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me." So this blood of the covenant that's mentioned here in Exodus is a foreshadowing of Jesus' blood, the blood of the new covenant. I guess we could say this is the blood of the old covenant, because this is the blood that was used to ratify the old covenant. We go now to Exodus 24, verses 9, 10, and 11. "Then Moses went up with Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and they saw the God of Israel, and under his feet there appeared to be a pavement of sapphire, as clear as the sky itself. Yet he did not stretch out his hand against the nobles of the sons of Israel, and they saw God, and they ate and drank." Now this going up again, I'm assuming that he's down on the mountain. This is the fourth time he's down. And again, I could be wrong about it. Several times, let's put it that way. Now he's going back up. Well, where is he now? Where did he eat that meal with the elders? Well, it must be at the foot of the mountain somewhere, or it could be across the boundary and partway up the mountain, as I said at the beginning of this audio. So it's not really clear in my mind where they were, but it's at a staging point somewhere before Joshua and Moses split out from them, and then before Moses split out from Joshua and Moses went alone to the top of the mountain. And that, again, is not of all that importance. Why were there 70 elders there? Because there needed to be witnesses so that the whole nation of Israel could say, "We saw God." Verse 10 says they saw the God of Israel. Now, I'm going to talk about in a minute how can you see an immaterial being, a spiritual being. We'll talk about that in a minute. But verse 10 says they saw God, and 70 of them did, plus the leader. So we won't have this situation like Joseph Smith up there in New York and like Muhammad, who claims that he saw God or saw an angel of God and the Quran was dictated to him. There's no witnesses. But here we have a divine speaking to a human being, and there's lots of witnesses. Now let's look at verse 10. They saw the God of Israel. Now, how can you see the God of Israel and not die? You notice that the implication is that normally you see the God of Israel, you're going to die, because in verse 11 it says, "Yet, even though they saw the God of Israel, he did not stretch out his hands." In other words, he didn't kill them like you would normally expect when you see God. So that's kind of the default position. You see God, you're toast. He's too much for us. Now, this is everywhere in the scriptures. I'm going to read you a lot of scriptures that show that you cannot see God. Then I'm going to show you some scriptures that says that you did see God, just like the one we just read. The elders and Moses and Aaron saw God, and they ate a meal with him, okay? So that seems like a contradiction. We need to reconcile it. So first of all, let's look at the scriptures that say that you cannot see God in his full glory. Exodus 33:20. "But he said," God said, "you cannot see my face, for no man can see me and live." Exodus 3:6, he also said, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." Then Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Genesis 16:13, "Then she," referring to Hagar, "called the name of the Lord who spoke to her, 'You are a God who sees,' for she said, 'Have I even remained alive here after seeing him?'" See, again, that's the default Jewish position. You see Yahweh, you croak. John 1:18, "No one has seen God at any time." John 6:46, "Not that anyone has seen the Father except the one who is from God," that's Jesus, "but nobody else has seen the Father." 1 Timothy 1:17, "Now to the King, eternal, immortal, invisible." You can't see God. 1 John 4:12, "No one has seen God at any time." Going back to the Old Testament, Judges 13:22-23, this is Manoah, the father of Gideon. Manoah said to his wife, "We will surely die, for we have seen God." But the wife said, there was an angel of the Lord, probably Jesus, that they saw at a sacrifice. Verse 23, "But his wife said to him, 'If the Lord had desired to kill us, he would not have accepted a burnt offering and a grain offering from our hands. Nor would he have shown us all these things, nor would he have let us hear things like this at this time.'" In other words, Manoah says, we're going to die because we saw God, because that's what Jews thought. You see God, you die. Actually, it was because it was the angel of Jehovah. He was God, but he was clothed in his pre-incarnate state, and so they weren't killed. But at any rate, that's one set of scriptures. Now let's look at some other scriptures that show that we can see God. Numbers 12:8, with him, I, God, speak Moses mouth to mouth. That's Moses with him. Moses, I, God, speak mouth to mouth, even openly, and not in dark sayings. And he beholds the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant, against Moses? Well, there Moses is seeing God, the form of the Lord. Ezekiel 1:28, as the appearance of the rainbow in the clouds on a rainy day, so was the appearance of the surrounding radiance. Such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of God, and when I saw it, I fell on my face. So Ezekiel saw God. Genesis 33:10, Jacob said, no, please, if now if I found favor in your, he's talking to his brother Esau upon his return from Padam Aram, Syria. He's trying to reconcile with Esau, and he says, if I found favor in your sight, Esau, then take my present from my hand, for I see your face as one sees the face of God. Well, Jacob's assuming that you could see the face of God. Okay, so how do we reconcile those two sets of scriptures? Well, I'm just going to give you one scripture that will do it. I'll just read it, and then I'll explain how this is a reconciliation. Exodus 33, verses 20 through 23. But he added, that's God added, you cannot see my face, for humans cannot see me and live. Verse 21, the Lord said, talking to Moses, here is a place near me, you're to stand on the rock. And when my glory passes by, I will put you in the crevice of the rock and cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will take my hand away and you will see my back, but my face will not be seen. So there's your reconciliation. You can't look at God directly in his full glory or you will be obliterated. But you can see him as his glory fades as it passes by. You can see the after effects of his glory, which is enough, really. So if God hides some of his glory, people can see him, and there's your reconciliation. This is the King James has the hind parts of God. You can see the hind parts of God, see his back. Now we have a slight problem with Deuteronomy 4:12 here because it says here in our verse in Exodus chapter 24, verse 11, it says they ate and drank. So Moses is eating and drinking. And it also says they, in verse 10, they, including Moses, saw the God of Israel. They saw him. And of course, we haven't talked about what that looked like here, but they saw him. Deuteronomy 4:12 says, the Lord spoke to you, spoke to Moses from the midst of the fire. You heard the sound of words, but you saw no form, only a voice. Well, here's a couple of options to solve the apparent contradiction. The fact that Deuteronomy 4:12 says that Moses didn't see anything, he just heard. And this verse that we just read in Exodus 24:10 that Moses saw God. Well, option number one to solve the problem, this refers, this verse in Deuteronomy 4:12, where Moses only heard a voice but didn't see anything, that refers to a different time than this eating of the covenant meal. Deuteronomy 4:12 says this option refers to the time of the giving of the Ten Commandments, when Moses went up into the dark cloud, if you recall, Exodus 20, and God spoke to him in a voice. He didn't see God then, he just heard, and he got the Ten Commandments that way. But this verse where we are now, Exodus 24:10, it's obviously after the giving of the Ten Commandments. It's four chapters afterwards. It's at the eating of the meal with the elders, and he saw God then. So that's the easiest way to solve that apparent contradiction. Jameson Fossum Brown solves it another way. He says that Moses and his fellow elders saw no form, only the sapphire under God's throne. Now, that would assume that Deuteronomy 4:12 is not speaking at the time of the giving of the Ten Commandments, but rather at the time of the eating of the meal with Yahweh. And I guess that would reconcile it, too. But I don't think that's the correct way to do it. I just think this Deuteronomy 4:12 is referring to the giving of the Ten Commandments. And our verse here in Exodus 24 is talking about the covenant meal that was eaten. And by the way, it was a meal. Meals are often given, well, usually, when there was a covenant between two people, they ate a meal. Well, here's a covenant. They're eating a meal. God was at the meal. He was one party, and the elders of Israel were at the meal. That was the other party. So it was a covenant between God and the people. Now you say, how can God eat at a meal? Well, obviously, God's a spirit. He's not going to eat, but he was there. It says, under his feet there appeared to be a pavement of sapphire. Now Ezekiel saw a throne with God on it, someone that looked like a man, so it could be God putting himself in the form of a man so he could appear there at the meal. Or it could just mean that it's speaking symbolically, metaphorically, that was there was a pavement of sapphire, a blue expanse which they saw, and above that would be God, but they didn't actually see God. That was just the place where God was standing, and it was not referring to his feet, literally, just like when we read about the finger of God writing the Ten Commandments on the rock, we're not talking about God's finger literally either. Well, there are your two options. Either he appeared as a human or is just speaking metaphorically, because God is a spirit. He does not have feet. Sapphire, of course, is bright blue like lapis lazuli. I'm not sure where the lapis lazuli is. I think that is a rock and sapphire is the color, although I think sapphire can also be a precious rock. It doesn't matter. The point is it's bright blue. It's interesting, in Ezekiel looked up and saw that expanse of sapphire. In Revelation, John, in the throne room of God, he looked down and saw that great sea of glass. The sea is blue. So he was looking at the throne room of God from above. Ezekiel was looking from below, and the elders of Israel here were looking from below. Now, this idea of them eating a meal with God, I use it to try to buttress my argument that when Jesus said, "I will eat it with you in my kingdom," he was talking about coming in his spiritual form, the real spiritual presence of Jesus at the communion meal, and he ate it, and he's still eating it with us after all these years. And people say, yeah, but he wasn't there physically to eat it. That's not going to happen until the end of time when we're all in heaven. To which I say, well, God ate a meal with the elders. At least he was there. I think it's a pretty good argument, in my humble opinion. I haven't seen anybody else make that argument, but I like to make it. I made it publicly in a teaching I just did recently in a church, and nobody seemed to choke on it too badly. Now let's look at this eating and drinking in verse 11 more fully. We have a full meal eaten here at the establishment of the old covenant, just like a full meal is eaten every Sunday under the new covenant, or it should be anyway. Of course, we moderns have fixed it up, so now we just have a sip and a chip, a little soda cracker, and a shot glass of wine. No, the agape feast, F-E-A-S-T, is a full meal, because you don't have a feast with just a shot glass of wine and a soda cracker. And, of course, all the church historians will tell you that the early church ate the Lord's Supper as a full meal. It was the agape love feast. So, there's your parallel between the old covenant and the new covenant. And look at this also. There was blood at the old covenant. Remember all that blood? We talked about blood of the covenant. Well, we got blood at the new covenant too, at least symbolically. Luke 22:20, and in the same way he took the cup after they had eaten, saying, "The cup which is poured out for you is the new covenant in my blood." So we got the blood of the covenant in the old. We got the blood of the new covenant in the new. See the parallel there. 1 Corinthians 11:25. In the same way he took the cup also after supper, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me." The new covenant of blood. Now, one last note about this meal. It could have been the meat of the peace offerings that was eaten, because peace offerings were often eaten between the priest and the people, or together. They ate it together. And they had just sacrificed peace offerings, so maybe that they didn't have priest yet. But maybe they took the meat of the peace offering and said, "This is fellowship. We're one. We're one with God and one with each other." We go now to Exodus 24, verses 12, 13, and 14. "Now the Lord said to Moses, 'Come up to me on the mountain and remain there, and I will give you the stone tablets with the law and the commandments which I have written for their instruction.' So Moses arose with Joshua his servant, and Moses went up to the mountain of God. But to the elders he said, 'Wait here for us until we return to you. And behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. Whoever has a legal matter, let him approach them.'" Now, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown makes a sort of an interesting analogy with the tabernacle and the Mount Sinai. He said the people at the base referred to the outer court of the tabernacle. That's the whole mass of Israel, the ones who hadn't crossed the boundary line. Then, when you go halfway up, where the 70 elders and Aaron and Hur and Moses were eating that meal, that was the holy place. And then, at the very top where Moses alone went, that was the Holy of Holies. Well, that's very creative. We'll give them a few kudos for that, but I don't really think that that's what God had in mind when he had the people separating out in this trip up. Although, could be. Now, God tells Moses he has to go up on the mountain and remain there. He had to wait for 6 days before God showed up in the glory cloud. Well, actually, God showed up in the glory cloud, as we'll see here in just a minute, and Moses had to wait there in that glory cloud with nothing going on until finally God revealed himself and said, "Okay, I'm going to talk to you some more, Moses." Here, God is telling Moses, "I'm going to give you stone tablets with the law." Stone will last a long time. You know, Hammurabi in 1700 or so B.C. in the old, he was the head of the old Babylonian Empire. He put his famous Hammurabi's code on a stone stele, and it's sitting in the Louvre. I remember walking around the Louvre and walked in and saw this big stone thing sticking up in the air. I said, I wonder what this is. There was nobody there in the room but me. There was no guards there. It was no big deal. I look at it and says, oh, this is the famous Hammurabi code that I heard about all my life. It's one of the most famous law codes in the history of the human race, sitting right there in a room in the Louvre. The reason it was still there, and I looked, put my eyes up to it real close. There was no glass. It wasn't even in glass. I could go up and touch it. I could rub it, which I didn't. And I went up and put my eyes right close to it, and I could see all the little, I guess it was hieroglyphs. I can't remember what it was written in, what script it was written in, cuneiform or hieroglyph, probably cuneiform. But anyway, it was written, and I looked at that, and I tried to take a picture of it. The picture didn't come out. But I thought, it's amazing. You're talking about, that's over 3.5 millennia, and it's just as clear as a bell. The stones weren't even, the text wasn't even blurred anywhere. It was just as sharp as it could be. So that's why God told, well, that's why he was going to have the law and the commandments written on stone tablets, because it was going to last a while. Now it says stone tablets. The standard explanation of that is that in ancient Near Eastern practice, when two covenant parties made a covenant, they would write the entire covenant would in duplicate, two different copies. One copy belonged to each party, so each party would have a chance to know what's in the deal. When we do that in law today, we give everybody a copy of the contract. Now, since God was one of the parties, and you can't exactly give God a copy of the contract, copy of the treaty, since he's in heaven, so what they did is they put God's copy and Israel's copy. They put both copies in the Ark of the Covenant later on when they built the tabernacle. Exodus 25:21, you shall put the mercy seat on top of the ark, and in the ark you shall put the testimony, which I will give to you. The testimony, of course, is the law. Now, tablets is plural here in our verse in Exodus 24:12. Tablets, I will give you the tablets, plural. Doesn't specifically say two, but we know that there are two tablets from Exodus 31:18, which says this, when he had finished speaking with him upon Mount Sinai, he gave Moses the two tablets of the testimony, tablets of stone written by the finger of God. Now remember, God had previously given the commandments orally. We see this in Exodus 20, verse 1. Then God spoke all these words, and Moses had written down the words, the Ten Commandments and the Book of the Covenant, too. He had written them down. We see that in Exodus 24, verse 4. Well, I've already mentioned this verse. It's in our current chapter. Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. Now later, God is going to write the Ten Commandments on stone, just as he's promised here. Let me read you the scriptures that talk about writing the Ten Commandments on stone. Exodus 24:12, which is our verse that we're looking at now. The Lord said to the Moses, come up to me on the mountain and stay there so that I may give you the stone tablets with the law I have written for their instruction. Now, we have to remember there were two sets of stone tablets, because as we go through here, we're going to see Moses got angry at the idolatry of the people, and he smashed in a fit of temper. He smashed the first set of stone tablets, so God had to rewrite them. Exodus 31:18, when he, God, finished speaking with Moses on Mount Sinai, he gave him the two tablets of the testimony, stone tablets inscribed by the finger of God. That was the first time that God had done this, had made the stone tablets. Exodus 32:16, the tablets were the work of God, and the writing was God's writing engraved on the tablets. Again, that's referring to the first time. Then in Exodus 34:1, the Lord said to Moses, cut two stone tablets like the first ones, and I will write on them the words that were on the first tablets which you broke. So this is the second time God wrote the Ten Commandments down on stone. Deuteronomy 10:2, I, referring to Yahweh, will write on the tablets the words that were on the first tablets you broke, and you are to place them in the ark. That verse, by the way, tells us that they're supposed to put the tablets in the ark. I mentioned that earlier. And so it's very clear that God wrote the Ten Commandments. Now, there's one scripture that causes a little bit of confusion because of an unclear reference to a pronoun, Exodus 34:27-28. The Lord also said to Moses, write down these words, for I have made a covenant with you and with Israel based on these words. Moses was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. He did not eat food or drink water. He wrote the Ten Commandments, the words of the covenant on the tablets. And doesn't that sound like Moses wrote the Ten Commandments? But Moses didn't write the Ten Commandments. I just finished reading you all these verses. God did. Well, the answer to that, or at least some commentators answer that by saying the he that wrote the Ten Commandments is referring to the Lord. The first antecedent, possible antecedent of he is Moses in verse 28. That's the closest one. And generally, you take the closest noun as the antecedent for the pronoun. Moses was there 40 days and 40 nights, and he wrote. But, according to Matthew Poole, it should be the reference, the antecedent to he should be the Lord. The Lord said to Moses, he wrote the Ten Commandments. The Lord wrote the Ten Commandments. But now some people, like Cambridge, says that it refers to Moses. I don't know how they handle that. How did Moses write it down when it clearly says that God wrote it down? All I know is this. I don't know why ancient Greek writers and ancient Hebrew writers were so unclear about their pronouns, because it comes up all the time, creates all kinds of theological questions. I remember I've gone through the whole New Testament, and how many times did I have to deal with what does this pronoun refer to? I remember when I was in high school in my English lit teachers would always say, make sure that your antecedents are clear that people, so people will know who you're referring to. But the people that wrote the New Testament figured that we needed to have some theological controversy and we needed to study some more and figure it out. So verse 13 says, so Moses arose with Joshua his servant, arose from the meal, the fellowship meal, with Joshua his servant. This is the famous Joshua, of course, that led the people across from Pisgah into across the Jordan River into the Promised Land when we get to the book of Joshua. So Moses arose with Joshua's servant, and Moses went up to the mountain of God. So Joshua went further up the mountain, but not all the way up to the top. Adam Clark says he probably went up to the cloud which covered the mountain. That was far enough, and he stopped. Well, whatever. We're going to get to that glory cloud in just a minute. Why did he go up with Moses? Well, he provided companionship for Moses. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says that the companionship was provided during the 6 days Moses had to wait before the Sabbath day that he met the Lord, when God finally came to him. So Moses was up there. It was probably kind of an awesome, lonely experience being up there alone on the mountain as the cloud covered the mountaintop. So Joshua was there with Moses, his right-hand man. Now, verse 14 has an interesting aspect to it. Verse 14 says, but to the elders, Moses said, wait here for us until we return to you. And behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. Whoever has a legal matter, let him approach them. Now, I think what Moses is saying is, look, we might be gone a long time. And during that time, we got 2.5 million, 3 million, I don't know, 600,000 men plus women and children down there. They're going to have legal disputes because people can't get along. There's going to be a legal dispute and somebody's going to have to handle it. Well, I'm not going to be around. So Aaron and Hur ended up marrying Miriam, Moses' sister. So Hur was Moses' brother-in-law. Aaron was his brother. They're there. Let Aaron and Hur take care of legal matters. Now, I'm sure that Aaron and Hur would have to go back down the mountain, past the boundary, if that's where they were. It's not clear that they were. But, of course, because the people are not going to cross that boundary. And so, at any rate, Moses assumed that he was going to be gone a long time because he had to appoint substitute judges. As it turns out, he was gone 40 days. Well, even 40 days, people are going to have legal disputes. It wouldn't surprise me with all those people. So Moses takes care of business. This Hur, by the way, you might recall him. He was one of the guys that held up Moses' hand at Rephidim right before they got to Mount Sinai. They were fighting the Amalekites. Joshua and the Israelites were fighting the Amalekites, and Moses was on top of the hill watching, and when he held his arms up, the Amalekites would lose. When his arms came down, the Amalekites would win, and so he got Aaron to hold up one arm, and brother-in-law Hur held up the other arm. Easton's Illustrated Dictionary tells us that Hur was the husband of Miriam. And Adam Clark confirms me when he says that the elders didn't stay the whole 40 days Moses was on the mountain. They went back to the camp. That's how they could handle legal cases. In fact, Adam Clark makes the further point that their return to camp is probably why the Israelites made the golden calf. They see the elders coming back. Where's Moses? Well, Moses disappeared up on the mountain somewhere. Oh, my gosh. He's our leader, and he's gone, and we're leaderless. We're here, helpless in the desert. Let's make a golden calf. We need some divine help. Exodus 24, verses 15 through 16. Then Moses went up to the mountain, and the cloud covered the mountain. The glory of the Lord rested on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it for 6 days. And on the seventh day, he called to Moses from the midst of the cloud. Now, I'm assuming this cloud, Moses didn't go into it yet. He did. He eventually went into it, but that was only at the seventh day, on the Sabbath day. But he had to wait for 6 days. He was under that cloud. Now, we see the cloud in verse 15 and verse 16. We see the glory of the Lord resting on Mount Sinai. Some people say the cloud and the glory are the same thing. that pillar of cloud by day. Some people say the cloud was on the mountain and the bright, shining glory of the Lord was on top of the cloud. I think it's probably the same thing, the same cloud, that bright, shining Shekinah glory cloud was resting on Mount Sinai. So it's a bright cloud, not a dark cloud. We can speculate. We don't know. We do know Moses had to wait there for 6 days. You can imagine what that must have felt like, sitting in a glory cloud or under a glory cloud for 6 days, waiting for further instructions. And notice how God reemphasizes that seven-day pattern that's everywhere in the law. We just finished going through in the Book of the Covenant the laws on the Sabbath. And, of course, creation week, 7 days, seven, 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 seven. It's everywhere. A yearly Sabbath, a weekly Sabbath, a yearly Sabbath. And then seven yearly Sabbaths make up the time of the year of Jubilee, 777. We go now to Exodus 24, verses 17 through 18. And to the eyes of the sons of Israel, the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a consuming fire on the mountaintop. That glory I just talked about, I think it's the bright Shekinah glory, because it was like a fire that's burning on the top of the mountain. Because they're down at the bottom looking up and seeing that. And of course, they're probably thinking, well, Moses, he's toast. Verse 18, Moses entered the midst of the cloud as he went up to the mountain. And Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. Now, it doesn't say whether the 40 days and 40 nights included the 6 days that he had to wait to enter into the midst of the glory cloud. Or maybe it was 40 days and 40 nights in addition to the 6 days. I don't know. Doesn't really matter. So Moses had plenty of time to be up there to receive instructions. And, of course, we're going to see all the rest of these laws in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Now, this 40 days and 40 nights is an interesting time period. It was a type of the fact that Jesus was in the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights, as the NIV Study Bible and John Gill point out. Jesus didn't eat or drink for 40 days and 40 nights, neither did Moses, Exodus 34:28. So he was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. He did not eat bread or drink water. Now, of course, that verse I just quoted was the second 40 days and 40 nights he was up there where he didn't eat bread and drink, eat bread or drink water. I assume he did the same thing on the first 40 days and 40 nights. I don't know, but that is a bodaciously long fast. I need to make a comment as I close this audio about the number of times Moses went up Mount Sinai. I calculated 4 or 5. I forgot what I've said. I wish I hadn't said anything, because I just now found an article on gotquestions.org that said that he went up 8 times on Mount Sinai. Of course, we hadn't finished yet, but I don't think my count would have hit 8. And then I found another website, biblia.com, that said it was 7 times, and it all depends on how you reckon it, and it's not clear. I wish I hadn't tried to figure it out on my own. It's a minor point. We'll leave it there. That's the end of Exodus 24. This prepares us for our next audio, in which we will discuss the events of Exodus chapter 25. Verses 1 through 22, we'll look at contributions for the sanctuary, where the money's going to come from to finance this thing. And then we're going to talk about the Ark of the Covenant, first half of chapter 25, verses 1 through 22. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you enjoyed this audio, and I hope you will stay tuned for the next one.